All right. Well, the door's shut, so we might get started. I'm Gillian Harricks, and I'm the chair for this session, which has the theme Measuring Outcomes in the NDIS from Theory to Reality. So we're really pleased to have Sally Galbraith here today, who's this is indeed her job, but she has a major role in developing and implementing the outcomes framework for NDIS. So I'm really looking forward to hearing from Sally. Sally's a fellow and has a PhD in biostats from the NHMRC. Can I just remind everybody, when you get up to ask questions at the end, and I'm sure there'll be lots, to please give your name for the record, and also encourage you to fill in any of the survey response forms that which you can do online. So over to you, Sally.
Thanks, Gillian, and thanks everyone for coming. Can everyone hear me?
Not sure.
Yeah, cool. Okay, so this talk is about the development of an outcomes framework for the National Disability Insurance Scheme, starting with some background on measuring outcomes generally, and then going on to look at how we went about developing the NDIS framework in particular. So I'll just start with some background to those people who may not be so familiar with the scheme. The National Disability Insurance Scheme commenced with four trial sites on 1 July 2013 in the Barwon region in Victoria, the Hunter region in New South Wales, South Australia, children in South Australia, and young adults in Tasmania. And then a year later, three more trial sites were added, ACT, a region in the Northern Territory, and also an area of Western Australia. And just recently a new site in Western Sydney has been announced. So the NDIS represents a fundamentally new way of supporting people with disability, and it represents a shift from the existing welfare system towards an insurance-based model. And as part of the insurance-based model, it places an emphasis on choice and control, early intervention and community inclusion for our participants. And so for those who want to learn more about the scheme, I recommend you attend concurrent session 4E, the next session here, where the scheme actuary, Sarah Johnson, will be presenting a whole lot more detail about the scheme in general. But looking at the outcomes framework that we've been developing in particular, the first thing we thought about in developing it was why we needed to have an outcomes framework and what would it be used for. So I guess at a sort of simple legislative level, the NDIS is governed by the NDIS Act 2013, and so we need to demonstrate that we're complying with that legislation. And in particular, sections 3 and 4 have provisions which relate to the measurement of participant outcomes. So firstly, section 3 lists the objects of the Act, which include things like supporting the independence and social and economic participation of people with disability, and it also refers to Australia's obligations under some other instruments, including the UN Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disability. And then Section 4 of the Act goes on to talk about how the Act will operate, and it sets out 17 general guidelines, general principles to guide that. And for example, the first principle is that people with disability have the same rights as other members of Australian society to realise their potential for physical, social, emotional and intellectual development. And there are a number of other policy documents that the scheme must be guided by. The first one up here is the NDIA Strategic Plan, and that plan is based on three major goals listed up here. Firstly, that people with disability are in control and have choices based on the UNCRPD. Secondly, the National Disability Insurance Scheme is financially sustainable and governed using insurance principles. And thirdly, the community has ownership, confidence and pride in the National Disability Insurance Scheme and the NDIA. A number of other policy documents that are relevant are the intergovernmental agreement that was signed by states when the scheme was set up, and that has an appendix which contains an integrated performance reporting framework, which includes items that are relevant to the measurement of participant outcomes. Another document is the National Disability Strategy, which contains six broad outcome areas, inclusive and accessible communities, rights protection, justice and legislation, economic security, personal and community support, learning and skills, and health and well-being. And thirdly, the National Standards for Disability Services, which also has six standards for disability service organisations. They're all listed up there, but the third one in particular is individual outcomes. So the legislation and the other policy documents and the need to show that we comply with those are all good reasons why we need to have an outcomes framework. But at a more fundamental level, the whole aim of the scheme is to improve the lives of Australians with disability and their families and carers. And so we need to be able to show that we are making a difference in that regard. And to do this, and I think this is, I guess, the fundamental purpose of the framework, we need to be able to monitor progress. And I think the quote up here by Muir and Bennett from the Centre for Social Impact puts the general case for outcome measurement quite well. They say our social progress has arguably been stymied because we haven't concentrated enough on outcomes. Together we've created a social purpose system that has good intentions but more often focuses counts and funds what and how much we do rather than whether we're making a difference. And that leads on to some terminology. I haven't really said what I mean by an outcome yet, and this slide looks at outcome and also the distinction between two other terms, output and impact. So the quote from Muir and Bennett about focusing on how much we do and produce is really an output. So outputs are services, products and funding, in our case, provided to our participants, whereas an outcome is the difference that those outputs would make to our participants. Or in other words, changes in targeted attitudes, values and behaviours or conditions between baseline measurement and subsequent points of measurement. So that last quote gets at the idea of looking at change. It's really important to look at how our outcome measurements are changing over time. Another term that's used in this area is impact, and that tends to mean longer-term or deeper changes that arise from achieving outcomes. So, for example, by providing funding to the young child here, that will have a flow-on effect, beneficial effect on the family, and hopefully in the longer term, a beneficial effect for society as a whole. Okay, so another bit about terminology is, again, the use of the word outcome and as distinct from an indicator. And this quote from the National Action Plan for Promotion, Prevention and Early Intervention for Mental Health points out that there's considerable confusion about the meaning of the terms outcomes and indicators. So in a research setting, an outcome usually refers to a result, whereas in a policy context, an outcome most commonly refers to what an action plan or a program or a project expects to achieve through implementation. And the most common definition of an indicator is information collected to monitor progress towards achievement of an outcome. So the NDIA strategic plan that I referred to earlier uses the terminology goals, outcomes, deliverables and success indicators. And the first three of those form a hierarchy. So, for example, goal one that I showed before is that people with a disability are in control and have choices. And underneath that goal, there are a number of outcomes. Outcome A being to build the capacity of people with disability to exercise choice and control in the pursuit of their goals. And then there are a number of deliverables, again, underneath that. Deliverable one being to encourage, enable and challenge people with disability to take control and self-manage their supports. So alongside that goal, there are a number of success indicators, the first of which is that people with disability plan and exercise choice, which is a good statement. However, we need to have a way of measuring whether that's taking place. So a possible measurable indicator to tell us that would be the proportion of people who self-manage their supports, and also looking at how that proportion changes over time. Okay, so coming back to the fundamental purpose of the framework, which I think is to monitor progress, there are three points related to that. The first one is we need to be able to track the progress of individual participants and their families and carers over time, so that we can tell whether things are improving for our participants. Secondly, by linking the outcomes over time with the supports that people are receiving, and also taking into account other risk factors that they might be subject to, and also just general demographic characteristics, we can build up a longitudinal model of outcomes with a number of explanatory variables, one being the supports, but also other risk factors and other characteristics. And the aim would be to use that model to identify what types of supports lead to good outcomes, and conversely, whether there are any barriers to achieving outcomes. And the third reason here is benchmarking. We would like to be able to see how we compare to Australians without disability generally, and also to other OECD countries. Okay, so this being an actuarial conference, I just thought I would take a few slides to look at the comparison of the scheme generally, and also with regard to outcomes measurement in particular, comparing the scheme with insurance and also with traditional disability systems. So if we think about insurance, an insurer will accept a premium in return for providing cover, and it's not open to them to deny a claim. They have to satisfy all valid claims, regardless of how many they get or the amount, and therefore they're subject to a certain amount of financial risk. On the other hand, a traditional disability system is generally block funded, and they have a capped annual budget. Once that budget has been spent, then they're not obligated to provide any more money. So they don't have the same kinds of financial risks as insurers, but obviously that system can lead to a lot of unmet need. So the NDIS shares features of both insurance and traditional disability systems. Like an insurer, it has an obligation to provide reasonable and necessary support to its participants. However, it is a disability support system. Its aim is to support participants and families and carers to achieve their goals over their lifetimes. So it is concerned not just with the financial result, but with participant outcomes in themselves as well. So looking now at the difference between how outcomes might, the focus might change with the scheme and insurers and traditional disability systems. In insurance, there's a kind of spectrum, you can think of a spectrum between short-tailed up to long-tail classes, where for a short-tail class, the focus is really on the speed and efficiency of settling the claim. But for longer-tail classes, such as accident compensation schemes, outcomes such as rehabilitation and return to work become much more important for claims management. For traditional disability systems, service delivery in the past has tended to be monitored by measuring inputs, such things like funds and staffing, and also outputs, which is just hours of care, for example, and numbers of clients. But for the NDIS, monitoring participant outcomes will play a really crucial role in the scheme. So the scheme takes a lifetime view of costs and benefits. So, for example, by providing early intervention up front, the hope is that costs over the longer term will be reduced. Looking at in a bit more detail about what's been done for outcomes measurement, firstly, this slide is on workers' comp. Workers' comp schemes around Australia are focused on return to work, obviously, as an outcome measure. And New Zealand and all Australian jurisdictions, apart from ACT, take part in the Safe Work Australia Return to Work Survey. And that survey focuses on work, but it also has some questions on health and a couple of questions related to choice and control. And those domains are ones that the NDIS will also be interested in. However, even though there are some overlapping domains, there's a different focus on the outcome measurement. So the work-related questions in the NDIS framework look at whether the participant has been able to find a job, whether they have support in their job, and the stability of their employment, whereas the return to work questions look at getting the worker back to work, I guess, and what that experience was like. For motor accident comp schemes, there has been quite a bit of work done on outcome measurement. For example, in New South Wales, the MAA has funded a number of studies, including BIOS, Brain Injury Outcome Study, also the Whiplash Study, and the Life After Injury Study. And also in New South Wales, the Lifetime Care and Support Authority conducts an annual participant satisfaction survey, which asks questions about whether the participant feels part of the community, whether they've worked or studied post-accident, and whether they've been able to spend time with friends. Some other examples: in Victoria, the Transport Accident Commission is conducting a longitudinal client research study of outcomes for about 1,500 clients, looking at pathways to recovery, and they also fund a longitudinal head injury outcome study. And in Queensland, the Motor Accidents Insurance Commission have funded a longitudinal study on physical and mental health of claimants. Okay, so looking at existing state disability schemes, the National Standards for Disability Services and other things have seen an increasing focus on outcome measurement here, but the implementation of those standards has varied quite a lot by state. So, for example, in New South Wales, they've aligned their standards to the 6 NSDS standards, and they have practice requirements and KPIs that relate to person-centred decision-making and achievement of an individual's own goals. Victoria has a set of 4 standards, and they apply across all social services, requiring goal-oriented plans and so on. And Tasmania is currently developing an outcomes purchasing framework, and that will also apply across social services. So it's clear that outcome measurement approaches vary by state, and a report done by National Disability Services in 2012 suggested that a variety of approaches were used by different service providers, and they included state government frameworks and also some independent frameworks, and also some providers didn't measure outcomes at that time. So the data that's available, nationally consistent outcome data is currently limited. So the national minimum data set has some outcome-related fields, for example, workforce participation, but it's not comprehensive and there's quite a lot of missing data. So it's difficult to draw comparisons using that data. And the final point is that the way state schemes have been structured means that outcomes are measured separately for each service received, and that can take away the focus on the person as a whole and looking at their own individual goals. Okay, so looking now at how we went about developing our framework, we started with a look at what the guiding principles for the framework should be. And pretty early on in the review of existing frameworks that we did, we identified two possible ways of measuring progress. So the first methodology is based on the concept of an ordinary life, which is really just the kind of life that every person should be able to aspire to. And in that, for that measurement methodology, progress would be measured by looking at the distance from an ordinary life. The second methodology that we came across was took a sort of more individual viewpoint, recognising that different people aspire to different goals, and so that methodology looks at progress towards achievement of those individual goals. And we recognised fairly early on that that we'd probably need elements of both those measurement systems in the framework. And just a few other guiding principles. We felt that the indicators needed to be meaningful, so widely accepted as important measures of progress. They needed to be informative in the sense of being able to identify what is working to improve outcomes and what is not. And finally, at a more practical level, they needed to be feasible to collect and report. So we need to avoid surveying our participants. They get asked to participate in a lot of surveys, and also we need to avoid undue burden on staff. So this is a picture of the process that we went through. It was, as you can see, a very iterative kind of procedure. We started up the top with a review of existing frameworks and also a review of ABS and other surveys so that we could find out what population information was available to benchmark. And at the same time as we were doing that, we were consulting with experts and stakeholders and groups within the NDIA and people with expertise in particular areas such as intellectual disability, Indigenous participants, culturally and linguistically diverse groups, and so on. And so we took, once we'd done the review and the initial rounds of consultation, we incorporated that into a draft report, and that report contained some draft domains and questions and indicators, which we put out for review again. And then once we'd done a second review and incorporated the further feedback, we put out the draft questions that we had for piloting with a sample of our participants. So that was done. The piloting was done starting at the end of last year, and we've just sort of got the final interviews in. I'll talk a bit more about that later on. So these are some of the existing frameworks that we reviewed, quite a lot. I guess some of the most useful ones were in the US, the National Core Indicators, or NCI. And this is a collaboration of state intellectual disability agencies. And the data collected is used to track performances of different states. And they have a good website which you can just use to interactively produce charts and so on based on their data. So that was useful. We also looked at the Council on Quality and Leadership Personal Outcome Measures, which has three major domains, myself, my world, my dreams. And that's also used as an accreditation system. It's used by some organisations in Australia as well. The UK frameworks were mainly initiatives of the UK government, the Fulfilling Potential Initiative and the Life Opportunities Survey, which is a large longitudinal survey, personally controlled budgets and so on. Some Irish frameworks. The Canadian framework is the University of Toronto Quality of Life Profile. This is the Being, Belonging, Becoming framework, and it is the one on which the National Disability Services Social Impact Measurement Toolkit is based. We also looked at that. And the population information that we reviewed were some ABS surveys, mainly the SDAC, the Survey of Disability, Ageing and Carers, also the General Social Survey, Survey of Mental Health and Wellbeing, Personal Safety Survey and the Australian Health Survey, and some other surveys including HILDA, LSAC, Longitudinal Study of Indigenous Children, and a report by the Australian Social Inclusion Board on how Australia is faring. And the final point on, final consideration of how we should develop the framework was we realised we needed to take what we've called a lifespan approach. So the Independent Advisory Council of the NDIA did a report on reasonable and necessary support across the lifespan. And the lifespan approach recognises that people have the potential to grow and develop at any stage of their life. And the reasonable and necessary support that's required at a particular life stage can be regarded as the amount of support that you need in order to meet the same milestones and achieve the same goals and aspirations as peers without disability. So thinking about what the sort of life stages should be, we came up with five different stages or cohorts, the first one being children from birth to school entry, then from school entry to age 15, young people aged 16 to 24, the main adult group 25 to 55, and then a group for older adults approaching retirement aged over 55. So we needed to have five questionnaires with a slightly different focus for each of those cohorts. And we also developed three other questionnaires, plain English versions, essentially, of the adult versions intended for people with intellectual disability or just people who needed plain English version. And they had pictorial versions associated with them as well. So I won't go through all of the domains for the different cohorts. This is just the adult, the three adult domains and the participant, the three adult questionnaires and the participant domains for those versions. So there are eight domains that we came up with. Firstly, choice and control, daily activities, relationships, home, health and well-being, lifelong learning, work and social community and civic participation. For the over 25 adults, the family domains were families have the support they need to care, they know their rights and advocate effectively, they're able to gain access to services and programs, they have succession plans and they enjoy health and well-being. So I'll finish up with a bit of a discussion on piloting the outcomes framework and how we went about doing that. So piloting was undertaken in Barwon, Hunter and Tasmania, those three trial sites. When we drew the sample, we stratified it just on questionnaire type because we wanted to have a sufficient sample size to analyse the different cohorts, except for Tasmania, which only has one age group, obviously. And effectively, I guess that's a stratification on age and whether or not the participant has an intellectual disability. So we ended up receiving interviews from almost 400 people, and that was just over 200 participant interviews and just under 200 interviews with a family member or carer, and those were conducted either face-to-face or by phone. So I'm going to present some results. These are in no way sort of definitive results or anything. They're fairly randomly drawn just to give you a flavour of the sorts of analyses that will be possible using the outcomes framework. but we've still got a whole lot more analysis to do on the data. So this first example is from participant domain 3, which was relationships, and this is a question that's also asked in the National Core Indicators Framework. So the red bars there represent the proportions for NCI, and the two purple shaded bars are our participants, the darker ones, the 15 to 24 age group, and the lighter ones, 25 and over. So there's three possible responses here are no, not often, sometimes, or yes, I often feel lonely. So I guess if we compare our participants with NCI, you can see that they answer no, not often, less frequently than the NCI ones, but they tend to answer sometimes more often. The answer, yes, I often feel lonely, depends. There's a suggestion here that it depends on age group, whereby the older age group say they feel often feel lonely more often than the younger group. So there is a suggestion of a difference by age group here, but it's not statistically significant. However, if we look at the second example, and this is an example from family domain 1, which is families understand their child or young person's strengths, abilities and special needs, and the statement, I have a positive view of my child's future. So the possible responses here are yes, I have some difficulty and I have a great deal of difficulty, and there's no comparison with the benchmark here. So the two different coloured bars are a family member of a child aged 0 to 15, that's the darker group bar, and the lighter bar, family member of a participant or carer of a participant aged 15 to 24. And here you can see quite a clear difference between the age groups. Over 70% of the younger age group say they have a positive view of their child's future, whereas only about 50% of the older age group do. And this is a statistically significant difference in this slide. So I'd just like to digress a little bit here and give a plug for longitudinal data. So the age group comparisons that I presented in the previous two slides are inherently cross-sectional. They represent groups of people of different ages at a fixed time, as opposed to a true longitudinal study, which would follow the same person or the same people over time as they age. And the problem with that, with a cross-sectional study, is that estimates of age-related change obtained from such a study can be biased because of the possible existence of cohort effects. And a cohort effect is a systematic difference between people born at different times. So this slide is a fairly striking example of a cohort effect. This is from some findings from the Australian Longitudinal Study on Women's Health. And there are three cohorts here. On the left-hand side, the younger cohort, and then a middle-aged cohort, and on the right, the older cohort. And the graph is showing BMI on the y-axis as a function of age in years for those three cohorts. And the lines represent a longitudinal tracking over time of those groups. So you can see for the oldest age group, we have a nice flat BMI trend. For the middle group, it's nothing like that. It's above it and it's increasing dramatically, and it looks like the younger age group is increasing even more dramatically. So, and you can only tell this because we have the longitudinal measurements. If we just did a cross-sectional study and tried to estimate BMI with age, then we'd likely get a biased estimate. Okay, so just another couple of examples of some analysis that can be done. This is looking at a correlation between two variables that we've measured. So this is outlook on life. This is the question that gets asked in the ABS surveys, thinking about your life over the last 12 months and what you expect for the future Do you feel, and it's a 7-point scale from delighted to terrible. And then, so that's on the y-axis. On the x-axis, it's the basic self-reported health question, which is how would you rate your health on a 5-point scale from excellent to poor. So you can see there's a... Oh, and the size of the points, because it's a discrete scale, just represent the number of observations at that point. So you can see there's a strong correlation. The left-hand plot is for the participant, and this is just the 15 to 24 age group, and the right-hand plot is the family member of a participant of that age group. So there's a strong correlation between health and outlook on life in both cases. If you can also do a matched analysis of the participant and their corresponding family member. And this is looking at the correlation between the health of the family member and the health of the participant, and also the relationship between outlook on life of both the participant and family member. So there's, again, there's a relationship, perhaps not as strong on the outlook question as on the health question. Okay, so just to wrap up, what are we going to do from here? So the first thing is we need to finish analysing the results from the pilot study. Secondly, we have a second round of... Oh, not a second round, but... A further round of feedback from a workshop we did in March with stakeholders that we need to analyse, and we need to incorporate the pilot analysis and the feedback into the questionnaires to try and improve them. There are some implementation issues that need to be considered. Who will collect the information? What participants will respond to the surveys? Will it be all of them? How will we collect the information, those sorts of questions. And then, obviously, we need to start collecting it. So, that's all. Any questions?
Okay, thanks. If you just come up to the mic and give your name, that'd be great. Thank you very much.
Hi, Sally. Julia Lessing, EY. Thanks for a really interesting presentation. Some of the work we're doing at EY is also in human services and using actuarial techniques. And we're seeing our government clients are also wanting to move away from outputs which are easily measurable and attributable to services that they're providing to outcomes. So really interested to hear about what you're doing here. One of the challenges that we keep coming up against is how do you measure that baseline? So one of your earlier slides was around outcomes being the difference between where things are at now and what that baseline is. But what sort of approaches are you guys using in terms of measurement of that baseline? So understanding whether or not over time, if those outcomes are changing, and presuming you're wanting some increases in outcomes, that you're measuring against an accurate baseline measurement that sort of would have represented the what if nothing had happened.
Well, I guess we'll be able to... So we'll have new people coming into the scheme, so we will, I guess, have an accurate baseline for our new participants who are coming into the scheme. So I guess in that respect, we will be able to get an accurate baseline because they will be newly entering the scheme. So I think that's the advantage of trying to start the measurement now while we're in the trial phase, because we'll be able to have a baseline.
Another person?
Hi, Claire White from Finity. Thanks for sharing. My question's around the linking between the measurement of outcomes and the financial sustainability component that you also have a focus on, and if there's any intention of linking the two, or you're thinking about them separately but in mind?
Well, I guess they're really important. I think the outcomes are strongly linked with the financial sustainability of the scheme because, I mean, you might... Well, I guess the idea is that by improving outcomes, then the financial sustainability of the scheme will be protected because people will be having good outcomes. And so, I mean, there is, I guess, a tension between if people want more than the reasonable and necessary, but hopefully that can be managed. I don't know, Sarah, did you want to say anything more about that?
Well, ultimately, yeah, we do think that because we've got a longitudinal record of every participant in the scheme, so we know exactly how much we spent on everyone, and we know the outcomes that we're getting. You've got a number of other variables that we collect to be able to understand, well, what drove good outcomes. Service provider, we did a really good job. If this community is particularly inclusive, because I'm always getting good outcomes in this area. So we definitely will be linking the two together. Even with the results we've got in the pilot, we can link that with the amount of money that's going to plan and what their individual goals are. So that's definitely the aim over time.
Don't all be shy. No one else has their hands up. If you have a burning question, please come to the microphone.
Barry Leung from Defence Health. Thanks for sharing your information. I'm interested in when you measure your outcomes, do you need to change your framework for different kind of disabilities?
We haven't, except to the extent we've got the plain English versions for people with intellectual disability. But we just think that these questions should cover all disabilities.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, we've done a fair bit of work around cultural appropriateness, so how the questions are asked to the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander population, how they're asked of people who are culturally and linguistically diverse. And we're doing a fair bit of work on how the questions are asked to people with a really severe cognitive disability. But ultimately, the questions are consistent across all of
Sally, in the domains that you're looking at, has anything come out in terms of some of those areas being more important to particular cohorts? Have you looked at it like that?
We haven't yet, no. So there was a lot of discussion around the domains, and in particular we thought about including another guiding principle that it had to be something that the NDIS could influence, but in the end we didn't require that. So, for example, the health domain is still in there. Just because we feel it's such a hugely important area for people with disability. But, yes, as to whether there's different domains that are different, I guess that hopefully that will come out in the pilot analysis, but we haven't looked in detail at that.
Anyone else with a question? Well, I might ask you all to thank Sally, and if you're hanging around for Sarah's session, then hang around. Otherwise, maybe go and grab a coffee out the back. Thanks very much.